The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
These last weeks I've been giving talks on speech, practicing with speech, and today I want to come back more specifically to meditation practice and mindfulness practice. And I want to do it first by a little bit explaining a verse, a chant, that's one of the key chants in our tradition. And so the chant in Pali goes something like this.
Anicca vata sankara uparvayo dhammino upakituva niruchanti tesang vupassamo sukho.
All constructed things are impermanent. They have the nature of arising and passing away. Having arisen, they come to an end. The stilling, the bringing of these constructions to peace, is the great happiness. So the key word in this verse is constructions. And if there's one word that you want to learn today, Pali word, is the word sankara. And sankara has the prefix san, which means the same as con in English, with. And then kara, same as karma, same root meaning to do or to make. So sometimes called formations, that what gets formed. I like to call them constructions, that which we, together, we make, structure. And this is a very important, in doing meditation practice in Buddhism, sooner or later it's very important to get a sense of the constructive activity of the mind, as opposed to just assuming that your experience is, you're just a passive, innocent recipient of everything that happens to you. And in this particular school of meditation, it's very important to start seeing that you have a contribution to make in how your experience is constructed. And so part of that is also the experience of suffering and the experience of happiness. It comes from that constructive, partly out of the constructive activities of the mind. So, so we'll come back to this now and then talk about mindfulness itself. So mindfulness is this very simple capacity to pay attention to what is happening while it's happening. So it's to be present for your breathing, while you're breathing, for your body, experiences you're being with your body, for your feelings and emotions as they're happening, for your mental activity, your thoughts, and constructive work as it's happening, and to be present for your experience around you in the world. And it's easy enough not to be so present. It's easy to think you're present, perhaps. And some of you, I think, today, coming here meditating, had some experience of the mind not being so present. Because inevitably you sit down, try to be present best you can, and to some degree the mind will wander off the present moment, will wander back into thoughts and activities. And this is pretty normal. And it's not like you're bad because of that. But that this is what we're working with, is to understand that activity and train the mind to be more and more present, so the mind is not out of control and freely kind of wanders off by itself here and there and gets into trouble, perhaps. So it's a training to be present. And as we be present, as we're paying attention to what's going on here, there's a variety of different ways of talking about mindfulness that is useful for different people, or different, useful for individuals at different times. And the way of talking about it, or kind of the analogies of the way we talk about mindfulness, has a lot to do as a corrective to a way in which our mind is constructing our relationship to our experience. So our, how we relate to what's going on, again, we're not simply the innocent bystanders of that, that simply things happen and I didn't have anything to do with it, thank you. But rather we relate to our experience in particular ways. So so for example, if something doesn't go your way, then some people will relate to that with frustration and anger, or assigning blame to themselves or to others. Some people, when things don't go their way, relate to that out of just discouragement and to give up. Some people, when things don't go their way, feel, wow, a challenge. I get to figure this out. And they kind of have a different... And so many, many different people can have very, very different relationships to the same thing, depending on their predispositions, kind of their relationship. So when people are doing mindfulness, paying attention, some people, in noticing, notice apart from their experience. They're kind of like the watcher. They kind of abstract themselves from the experience. They're up in the control tower, perhaps, and they're watching their experience. The experience is out there, and they're kind of detached from it or pulled back. And other people, when they experience something, are right in the middle of it. You know, the more the better. It's juicy. They're kind of caught in it. They're involved in it. It feels oppressive. It's weighing them down. They're not apart from it at all. They feel like, I'm in the middle of this, and this is just a mess. Or I'm in the middle of it, and this is great. I just love being in the middle of stuff. So some people hold back. Some people go in. Some people hold back because they have aversion, resistance. I'm not going there, thank you. Some people hold back and watch because they found that being a watcher creates a very peaceful kind of approach to being present. As opposed to being entangled with what's going on, they find by stepping back and watching that they're not so entangled, not involved, not fighting, struggling, grabbing onto what's going on. They're more relaxed. And then things tend to unfold much better. Some people find that by being right in the midst of their experience, they're really intimate, they're really there present, they really see and feel and understand what's going on much, much more carefully. And it allows their inner experience to unfold to as it needs to unfold, to evolve. And if they hold themselves apart from it, there's some way in which that holding apart for them doesn't allow the inner life to unfold as fully. It's like you don't give space to what's there. some people... So there's different ways of relating then to our experience. You can be outside of it or you can be inside of it. One way to be outside of your experience is to be in your thinking about it, thinking about your experience a lot. Thinking, for the most part, I like to think about thinking, that thinking is about. It's the world of aboutness. So if I'm thinking about my lunch, that's about not what's happening now. And in fact, even if I'm sitting eating my lunch and I'm thinking about my lunch, the thoughts are not my lunch. And in fact, it's possible to be so caught up in the thoughts about something that that's happening right now, we don't really notice what is actually happening. And I've had that experience with food. I'm thinking about, how did that cook make that? You know, how can I do this? You know, I can maybe do a better job, this and that. And then I notice after a few moments, you know, I didn't really taste those last bites. Even though I thought I was in the present, I was thinking about what was going on in the present moment. But it's about. And so we see there's a very famous cliche in our particular Buddhist tradition, for better or worse. It came from a teaching in India to a student. The thoughts about your mother are not your mother. And that was very liberating for the person that first heard that. And when I was a new Zen student, I went to my Zen master and talked to a little bit about my relationship to my father. And he more or less said the same thing, but a little bit more evolved. He said that for me, when I think about my father, he's my father. But my father, as a person, was a person before I was born, had a whole life of his own. And now that I left home, had his own life. And so he was much bigger and broader of who he was than just the father. And I realized that I had kind of kept him in this one particular category about, you know, you're the father. And so I kind of opened up my vision that this person is much, you know, has much more to him. So when we're caught up in our thoughts, we're removed from experience. And it's very common in spiritual circles for people to offer as an antidote to living in thoughts, being separated from experience and your thoughts, by encouraging you to be intimate with your experience, or to be in your experience. And the Buddha has this language when you pay attention to the breathing, be aware of the breath within the breath. Be aware of the body within the body, which suggests this kind of intimacy. And it can be quite lovely to drop down into your body, kind of like you settle into a wonderful, wonderfully satisfying a pool of water. Or you put on a very nice kind of a set of clothes that fit you just perfect or something, or wrap yourself in a blanket and feel kind of cozy. Kind of it's going to drop into your body and feel like you're in your body fits, your skin fits you just perfectly, and you're kind of there and kind of feel your body from the inside. It can be beautiful and it can be luscious. And some people are very sensually oriented and they love this teaching. Let me just kind of get in the body and feel it sensually. But then that can be overly done. And then they're holding on, they're attached to that experience because it's so great and so wonderful. So what I'm trying to suggest is that depending on the particular constructive relationship we tend to have, different instructions are useful as an antidote. If we hold ourselves apart in a way that's not helpful, then it's good to have the instructions. Let's enter the experience. If we enter the experience too much, like with emotions, some people are completely in their emotional life and they're overwhelmed by it. Gee, you know, he's telling me to get into the emotions, feel it more fully. I'm about to break. I'm drowning in all this. I'm wallowing. And I need to step out of it and get some distance from it. And if I can get some distance from it, then I'm not so identified with it. I'm not, it doesn't control me and I'm being pushed around by it. And I have some space around it. And as I have space around it, I can understand it better. I can allow it to kind of unfold more healthily. So people, you have a choice in meditation. You can kind of get closer to the experience or you can step back. Some people find it very, very liberating to be a watcher, just to watch the experience in a very passive, neutral way. Some people find when they're too much the watcher, they're too aloof. The watching itself is kind of a not allowing yourself to really be there for the experience. Some people prefer to be that intimacy, really connected, involved. Are you following so far? Okay, so that's but both of those are constructive activities. The first is you're constructing a relationship of being apart or being intimate. And if it's a problem one of those ways, then you construct a different relationship as an antidote. If it's a problem to be apart, then you construct the idea of being intimate. If it's a problem of being too close and involved, then you have this idea, let's pull back and be more distant from all that. Or perhaps being a watcher or being kind of detached or kind of aloof, or not aloof, but kind of a little bit pulled back from the experience and watching it, that's just right for you. And so you stay there, stay with that relationship. But you don't treat it as a natural phenomena. So what we're doing here is we're questioning how it is we tend to relate to our experience, as opposed to assuming that how we relate to experience is a given and that's how the universe was constructed. It was for me to relate that way. So we begin to question, and everyone has a relationship, and we can begin questioning that relationship. So as you're staying in meditation and doing something as simple as watching your breathing, how do you relate to that experience? What do you add to that? Are you hesitant? Are you far away from it? I'm not going to get too close, thank you, to that breath. Are you curious? Are you connected really closely? Are you tracking it nicely? There's a variety of different things that you can kind of contribute. So then it gets more interesting. Because in all these relationships, there's two things. There's a thing you're three things. There's a relationship. There's a thing you're relating to. And then there's you that's relating. The agent, the person who's relating. And this is very interesting because often when there's a problem in our life, we get interested in the problem and we can think about it and be apart from it, or we can have some relationship to the problem. And one of the very natural relationships is, I would like to fix that problem. Let's get that problem to go away. But there are three elements involved here. There's the problem, there's the relationship. So you can study the problem, and sometimes that is the right thing. You can study the relationship to the problem, And sometimes you discover that how I'm relating to the problem is the real problem. And in fact, there is no problem except the relationship I have. And so that's interesting. But then there's a third element, is that you who's in the relationship, you who's having a problem. And it's very seldom that people turn around and question and look at the one who is experiencing. The one who is apart watching, the one who is intimate and involved and connected. So one of the things we do in meditation practice at some point is we begin bringing our attention to that sense of self that's engaged one way or the other. The sense of self that's involved in creating that relationship. And we say that that sense of self is also a constructed activity. We might often assume that that sense of self is a, you know, naturally given phenomena. I just showed up here like this, thank you. I'm just, you know, was given this sense of self, and that's the way it is, and there's no questioning it. And very few people actually question or look, investigate. But what we're asked to do in meditation at some point is to turn the attention back and look at that sense of self that is constructing the relationship, that's engaged in it all. And some people will find that that sense of self has some kind of there's something interesting there. There might be a sense of pressure or tension or unsatisfactoriness, or there might be fear, there might be greed, there might be desire, there might be some kind of stress. It might be very, very subtle. And one of the very fascinating things to do in meditation is to turn and see if you can find, this is best done when the mind is a little bit calm, but turn around and see if you can identify or locate that tension or the pressure that represents your sense of self, or represents that place that's constructing the relationship. And then either watch that from apart, just be there and watch it, or sit right in the middle of it, that tension, that pressure, that or that activity, that agitation that might be that sense of self. And then see what happens. And one of the fascinating things that can happen after a while is that when we start seeing the constructive activity of selfing, the self happening, and that construction gets peaceful, it gets really happy. And that's what the chant is about. All constructed things are impermanent. So even the sense of self, which can be seen so solid and so important, because it's a constructive activity, is impermanent. It has a nature of arising and passing. And if you bring this constructive activity to stillness, to peace, there is happiness. And when that happens, then there's awareness that is not located. As long as there's a location, I'm here and I'm watching the experience there, or I'm here and I'm in the middle of my experience, you're locating awareness, you're locating yourself. But awareness doesn't have to be located. Awareness does not need to be in relationship to anything. So we say mindfulness is, you know, watching, or mindfulness is intimate and present. But the awareness that mindfulness kind of, the awareness that supports the mindfulness doesn't have to be apart, doesn't have to be in, doesn't have to be here, doesn't have to be there. The awareness can just be. And that sense of being, that's kind of like space. Where's space? Is space there? Is it here? Space, you know, in some ways kind of interpenetrates, has no locations, perhaps. So the awareness without any location. Or some people, not necessarily Buddhists, would say that it's self without location. And if there is no self, there's no awareness without location, then there's no starting point from which to be to have a relationship. And is that okay? To be present without a relationship? I've been reading lately about Christianity in America, and I've been struck over and over again how it seems, at least in the main currents of Christianity, in the West Judeo-Christian tradition, being in relationship with God is really one of the very, very key elements. Being in relationship. And I think it's kind of built then into the Western, much of the Western idea of self, that what's really key and important is about being in relationship. Being in relationship to others, to people, to things, and all that. And that's a very important part of life. Don't want to dismiss it or diminish it, that being in relationship to things. But what about relaxing that constructive activity of relating? And that's what, so as meditation allows you to get calmer and more settled, it allows you to settle away, let things drop away, not to diminish yourself, but so that this deeper capacity for happiness can bubble up. All constructive activities are impermanent. They have the nature of arising and passing away. Having arisen, they will pass away. Bringing the constructive activity to stillness or to peace is the great happiness. So, did you have comments? Any questions? Yes.
I've also heard that chant where conditioned is used instead of construction. Would you comment on that difference, please?
Yes. I think it's most common to translate this word sankhara as conditions. Asankhara is unconditioned. There's a conditioned reality. It's that reality, those activities, those things in the world would come together because of conditions. So the weather is conditioned because conditions come together in a certain way, and so they're there. The economy is a conditioned phenomenon that no one understands, but conditions come together and there's there. So much of our life is based on conditions. In fact, Buddhism says almost everything is based on conditions. But condition—the word condition—I think it's probably the best translation of it. I don't know. I know I prefer constructive, because it seems to kind of condition seems a little bit more passive. Constructive is more, can be more a sense of, you know, something we're doing, an activity we're constructing. So constructive activity, and has more popular translation of this term sankhara is formations. So the mental formations, that the mental activity gets formed and created. So I like constructive, partly because no one else is using that. So that if it kind of, when you use a word kind of fresh, new word, then people think about it some, like you're asking. If I'd use the word conditioned, you would have fallen asleep on me. Because you've heard it before.
I like the word constructed also because when you just say mental formations, it just sounds like it's something floating in the air and you don't have any responsibility. And so I really appreciate your giving us this new word. The other thing I wanted to say about is I really like this concept of awareness without being in relationship. And I'm wondering, this other term I've heard, I think it means the same thing, which I also really enjoy, is choiceless awareness. Is that the same thing, right? I don't know.
It could be the same thing. So if it's the same thing for you, then great.
It's like, you know, the Dharma doesn't discriminate.
Yes.
And so therefore, we're not making choices about, well, I'm relating to this, but I'm not relating to this, and I'm attracted to this, and I'm revulsed by this.
Exactly.
It's just like you're just aware without being in relationship. Thank you.
So aware without preferences. So now, Betsy, please.
Thank you. I am interested in the relationship as the mind picks up. We have been taught to label neutral, pleasant, unpleasant. the distinctions between these categories as one progresses on the path towards Buddhahood, do they soften and disappear completely? What is your experience, Gil?
My experience is that I have an easier and easier time with pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral experience. With pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, just kind of is built into the system. They're just there. Certain kinds of unpleasant things I have less of. Certain kinds of pleasant things I have more of. But I have my plenty share of pleasant and unpleasant. I mean, just sitting right here now with you. I'm not with you. Yeah. I mean, I have pleasure. Certainly sitting here and hearing your question, and you're here, I have pleasure. And my ankle's starting to hurt. That's unpleasant. I'm sitting here for a while. That's unpleasant. And I can probably find something neutral, too. And there's all this stuff is here. And I just kind of go, you know, just fine. So.
Hi, I'm Carla. When I was listening to what you said about the self, I wondered if it means what I've heard elsewhere is sort of there's a need to give up the self. I'm very attached to myself. Is that really what you were speaking of? Locating the tension? I struggled with that. Can you help?
Yeah. If we want is to bring the mind to some deeply peaceful place, or if we want is to bring ourselves to be free of suffering, free of stress in some very deep, profound way, then we have to address those things which are stressful, those things which are, those constructions that have to do with suffering. There's a lot of stress and suffering around this issue of self, around the construct of self. So the key thing is not necessarily giving up some sense of self that you have, but is giving up the tension that's around it, the stress that's around it. And as you let go of that stress, what happens to your concept of self? Chances are that some of that self-concept will shift and change as there's less stress. But some of it you're able to hold without any clinging connected to it. So there's some things that I can hold very lightly. You know, I'm a man. Sometimes, most of the time, I don't care. I'm a resident of Redwood City. That's part of my sense of self. I mean, I hold that pretty lightly. I don't suffer because of being a resident of Redwood City. So there's a whole series of things, you know, that we can hold. This is who I am. But we hold it so lightly. There's nothing. You know, it's almost like, you know, clouds, the way it's held. But it's still, the fact that it's held so lightly doesn't mean we don't operate from that point of view. It doesn't mean that we don't take responsibility from it. It doesn't mean that we don't say no or take care of ourselves. The key thing in Buddhism is not letting go of a sense of self, but letting go of the tension and that's connected to that. In deep meditation, or in particular times, it's really beautiful to be alive and present without any sense of self operating whatsoever. And if someone is attached to a sense of self, then they limit that possibility. If they have a sense of that, or some kind of appreciation for that possibility, then it's easier to understand the value of holding self-concepts lightly. Does that make sense? Is that helpful?
Yes, yeah.
Is that samskara?
Yes.
With an S? Well, you gave this talk a couple months ago, called it Relational, Non-Relational?
Yes.
Okay. Why'd you change to... Is that seasonal, or...?
Yeah, either because I have a new relationship to it, or to keep you awake, keep you on your toes. So what I said here today was that that there's and it, there's different ways of practicing mindfulness depending on where you're at. And sometimes it's useful to take on the idea, I should be more intimate with my experience. And sometimes it's useful to take on the idea, I should be separate from it and watch it. And that's really, you know, the right medicine for particular states or an antidote for particular, you know, to meet something. And then I said also it's time, it's possible to have no relationship at all and just kind of have awareness that's not localized. We want to be very respectful. In Buddhist practice, we're very respectful of where we're at. And we don't hear some ideal, oh, I'm supposed to be now awareness without any relationship and just be here like, boom. You know, and then you're trying to do something that might be impossible. You want to start with where you're at. And so we have kind of, Buddhism has kind of a developmental approach to spiritual practice. You start where you're at and you have to figure out what's the most useful thing for me, given what's happening now. And then as we get the sense of the territory and develop ourselves, then it varies, then things change and evolve as we as the practice unfolds. So just that. Yeah.
Okay, if awareness is non-located, what happens when you go to sleep? Why isn't it located in my brain?
Why is it an important question?
Thank you for your answer.
Well, I hope that you took it that way. And there are a variety of very interesting questions, and that's certainly an interesting question, a valid question, but it kind of belongs to a little bit more of the theoretical side, at least in my mind. One of the approaches in Buddhism is what is functionally useful. What's functionally useful questions? So what's actually in terms of what's functioning? What happens when we're not present? If we go to sleep and we're in deep sleep and there's no awareness or seemingly no awareness, there's no functional awareness perhaps. And so then in that situation, there's no need to have a functional response. And that was part of the way I responded to him, was why was it important? Hope that made sense. Okay, so one more, last one, Fiona.
Could you just do the chant?
Oh, do the chant again. Some of you have probably heard it chanted different ways, different styles or tones or melodies or whatever. And mine is a little bit idiosyncratic. Anicca vata sankara upadavai yodamino upakituva niruchanti te sang upasamo sukho. Thank you. That last word, sukho. Can you say that? Sukho. That's Pali for happy. Isn't that a good word to know?